You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
Welcome, everybody, to Here District. I'm the captain of this vessel. We call it the Fantastic Voyage around here. Mark, just in case you didn't know. See, that song was written by my cousin of Lakeside, Fred Alexander. He's actually a cousin of mine. Yeah, so we're the Fantastic Voyage. I'm the captain.
Okay.
And this is my first mate, Chris Johnson. I don't know if you knew this, but me and Chris, we're the only father and son duo in the history of basketball. This is Hall of Fame worthy within itself. In the history of basketball, to win a national championship at the same school, UCLA 1975-1990. Only two to win one at the same school. Mark, there's been other guys that have won national championships. Can you rattle off two or three guys off the top of your head for me? Father-son duos that have won national championships. Just put you on the spot here early. Just see what your mind is like. How it's clicking. You got Scott May, Sean May. You got Henry Bibby and Mike Bibby. I think I'm leaving somebody out, but that's okay.
The same school, though.
No, I was saying, they weren't at the same school, but they won national championships. We're the only two to win a national championship at the same school. But let me introduce you first. Mark J. Spear. The J stands for giant. No, what's the J stand for?
When I was a kid, I used to tell kids Joe Mama.
Like ate your mama on the pancake box? No, but Joe, so you used to say Joe Mama.
It's Joe. Joseph,
Mark Joseph Spears. I was guessing John.
But I used the J period was a seventh grader's decision. I decided to be a sports writer in the seventh grade.
The J without the period or J period. What is
J
it?
Period. I got it. So my pen name, instead of, you know, that in the seventh grade when I started writing in a school paper, I'd use Mark J. Spears.
Okay.
And
okay.
I just used it ever since.
All right.
That's what I did in the seventh grade.
And you've come a long way since then, buddy. You've come a mighty long way. You are now the senior NBA writer for ESPN's Antscape. And Antscape, what is that? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Antscape is, Monis, who your super producer, used to work with us there. He was one of the original, what used to be called the Undefeated. It's a website based on race and culture and sports and entertainment. And so when I got the job in 2016 to cover the NBA for Antscape, basically it was like the handcuffs are off. Write about black people of color, women in the NBA world, in the basketball world, and nobody's handcuffing you.
Well, now this is with Antscape, or was that Undefeated also?
Changed the name.
Why the name change? Any particular?
There was a clothing brand by the name of Undefeated, which people wear. And
right, I got you.
Apparently, it was some legal issues, so they decided to change the name.
Okay, but I love everything you do, man. You do a terrific job. You've been covering this league, man, for what, almost two decades?
25 now. I did
25 years.
My 25th season.
Like 18 NBA Finals, 18 All Star Games.
That's more than that.
That was probably an old article that I read. But 20 and 20. So man. So you know
about
this league.
24 NBA Finals and 24 All Star Games.
Oh man, that's special.
You know, I ain't got your lineage, but I did all right.
So let's talk lineage. We talked about me and Chris. Father and son duo, same school. What's your basketball lineage? We'll talk about you and basketball and your love for the sport. How did that develop?
I fell in love with basketball going to San Jose State basketball camp in the sixth grade. Bill Berry, the legendary Ricky Berry, God rest his soul, was my childhood idol. Not Rick Berry, Ricky Berry, for Cali people know. He was Kenny Smith called him Reggie Miller with handles.
Yeah.
He was a cold basketball player and made the all rookie team.
Right.
The 88-89 season. And unfortunately, I don't want to get into it here, but he had a really tragic death.
Well, yeah. But the thing about it, Marcus, is I always talk about on our broadcast the 6 degrees of basketball separation. Yeah. And we're all kind of interconnected some kind of way.
Yeah.
When I was recruited by Cal, I don't remember who the head coach was, but Dick Davey was one of the assistant coaches. The other assistant was Bill Berry. Bill Berry was the other assistant. Then he got the San Jose State job. So I started following him. His son, Ricky, loved his game, watched him play like a 6'7" fluid guard.
Just nice.
And then like you mentioned, yeah, the tragic death. I mean, God, and just as a father of five sons, man, and Bill Berry was the nicest guy. Coach Berry was the nicest guy in the world. And after he had gone through what he went through with the death of his son, I just grieve for him.
I'm going to tell you what, to kind of fast forward my basketball thing, because I want to see if Chris is connected to this. We never spoke about this.
Okay.
Chris will find this interesting. In San Jose, I was, I wasn't Chris Johnson, but I was all right. I was like all region, played in the All-Star game up there. But I was one of the original pump camp. I'm talking real West Coast now. Y'all know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there was a camp at Cal State Dominguez Hills, the camps was outdoors then. So, right. Chris, was you in that camp? It was an outdoor camp. I might be a little older than you.
It might have been a couple years.
I'm at the camp. I remember Charles O'Bannon played. Ed was hanging out. He was too good. You know what I mean? Like Cam Murray was a young buck. Lamont Murray played.
Wow.
And so at that time, Monty Buckley was one of my roommates.
Okay.
Cal fame. Everybody know my Buck. And we got a call away from the camp from a guy named Eric Sawney, who was an assistant coach at San Jose, or used to be at San Jose State at the time. He tried to get me to play for Columbia in New York, and my grades wasn't good enough.
Okay.
So that still bites me to this day at that time. But
before Chris jumps in, let me tell you about this. I just made a list recently of like the five quickest guys in LA basketball history. One of those guys was a guy by the name of Eric Sawney from Mount Carmel High School here in Los Angeles. Eric
Small
and I
world, up, man.
We grew up playing against each other at Audubon Middle School back in the Eric early 70s.
If you catch up with him, give him my number.
I will do that, man. He was lightning. But he had he was just, Chris, you won't believe how quick this dude was. But.
Yeah. And a quick aside about Buck, Mark, in my like second CBA training camp in South Dakota for the Sioux Falls Skyforce, Buck was there, and that's when I really got tight with him, started hanging out with him. He became sort of a mentor, big bro, showed us like amazing love. Like Buck is one of the all-time guys for me as far as in this basketball game, just like an OG type that, bring you on.
That's crazy, Mark, because I was thinking about with this conversation, I was thinking about, man, I was, just being on the same wavelength. I was thinking about Bill Berry. I was thinking about Ricky Berry just before we went on. I was like, I don't know if Mark had any connection with those guys.
I wore number 34 in junior high and high school.
Yeah,
in college because of Ricky Berry. I got to know him at the camp, and I remember one of the first days of camp, I was like in the sixth grade or going to seventh grade. He goes, "Ain't none of y'all kids can steal the ball from me. None of y'all like challenges." So I didn't care about the rest of the camp. The whole time I was there, my whole goal was to take the ball from him. That's all I cared about, right?
Yeah.
So about a day or two in, he wasn't paying attention. That was still on my mind. And I ran and snatched the ball under his arm and took off.
Uh-oh.
And all the kid campers, yeah!
That's
And ever since then, like, he respected me.
Yeah.
And I would, like, go to their games at the Civic Auditorium. And so fast forward. I'm playing at San Jose Andrew Hill High School. I got invited to the pump camp, which was big for me. It was very validating, as Chris knows. Mr. Johnson, as I call to be invited to that was a huge for my confidence. But so Mr. Sawney, Coach Sawney, grabs us out and got me and Buck, and he pulled us to the side. And I'm like, what did we do? Because we're in the same dorm. Did we do something? Why would he pull us aside? He brought us in a room, and, I guess we could let the cat out of the bag for people that didn't know, Ricky Berry committed suicide.
Mm.
And he had told us that at that camp.
Wow.
And I just remember being crushed, Buck being crushed. We still talk about that when we see each other. I've written a few stories on it if people want to. But I think he would have been a Hall of Famer, superstar in this league. He made 8 threes in a game his rookie year.
Sacramento Kings, right? I mean, like,
yeah, there's a lot of depth to that story. Bill Russell was his head coach at the time.
Okay.
But I remember my mom telling me, like, I think you should change your number. You know, you don't need to fall that. I said, I'm only falling to good things. You ain't got to worry about that.
Right,
you
know?
God rest his soul, man. People like, there needs to be a documentary done there, which, you know. Maybe,
you're right.
Chris, we could collaborate and figure that one out. You know some folks in LA, but that Ricky Berry story is, you know, for an NBA player that had done that in the 89.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people could learn about mental health from him.
Well,
you
know, and that's a thread, man, that kind of connects us, man. Because, Chris, you know what I'm thinking about. When I think about those kind of tragic stories, read my mind, son. What am I thinking about? What was our moment, our tragic story moment when you came to me early in the morning?
Well, he woke me up. You woke me up. I think I can't remember the date. I think it was 86. But Len Bias,
man, just been, you know,
found,
what I mean?
And my dad woke me up out with the news.
Yep, because we loved Len Bias. We was watching all, you know, his ACC games and at Maryland, and then to hear his passing. Same thing with Ricky Berry. I tell you, when I heard about that, I immediately thought about his dad and me being a dad with sons and all that. And so anyway, man, let's So that's good stuff, though, just knowing you're San Jose. Now, who would you
but
say
the,
is...
But to fast forward, I played 2 years at Foothill College, played 1 year at a HBCU, a University of District of Columbia. Wasn't happy with the academics. I gave up a full scholarship, transferred to San Jose State.
Yeah.
Blew out my knee and actually had a beef with the coach about a story I wrote about the lack of black coaches in college basketball.
Okay.
He kind of figured out a way to push me out because he didn't like that story. But you could look that story up, too. That's a long story for another day about what happened there.
District of Columbia. Earl Jones, am I tripping?
He was way before me.
He went there. That was his school.
Yeah, no, they were like national champs in 82.
Okay.
Had Amadou Fall, the president of the Basketball Africa League. He was on my team.
Okay.
We're like brothers now.
Right.
But we lost 9 players because of grades and injuries. So we were playing with 5 players and 2 walk-ons. It was a little challenging of a season.
Yeah. No, man. And then congratulations in 2023. I got a quick story to tell here. I was on the concourse, Chris, doing a Bucks game, and I ran into Mark Spears. And Mark came up to me and said, "You gonna make it to the Hall of Fame this year? You gonna make it?" I was like, "Yeah, whatever, Mark. Okay, thanks, man." He's like, "No, you're serious. You gonna make it?" And when Mark was so, you know, he was so vocal about it, man. He had me convinced. Mark, you lied to me, man. I didn't make it again, man. Mark, you lied to me, man.
The world ain't over. The world ain't over.
It's all good.
Hey, man, I'm very proud to be a member of the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame as a writer, having won the Kurt Gowdy Award. But it will warm my heart when you're, you know, we're teammates.
Yeah, no, that's all
good. Because you should have been there long before I even, like, had that opportunity. So
well, I'm glad you said
know,
that.
I mean, you take your flowers, brother. Your numbers speak for themselves. And I think the younger generation, man, like, I think one of the things that pains me about the NBA is they don't have the videos of y'all games, man, where people can peruse them like they do baseball, like they do. Like, I could see more videos about Babe Ruth playing and Ted Williams than I could see Marcus Johnson playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is that? It's because the NBA wasn't, and the ABA didn't, you know, have all their games on TV and didn't have it. But people, you know, ballers know.
Yeah.
Hoopers know. And that Springfield deserves to have it. Should have. They need you more than you need them.
Well, and I tell the story all the
time. So respect, man. No, I'm telling you this, respect.
I appreciate that, man. And it's funny, I told the late, great Bill Walton, we were at Bob Lanier's Memorial in Las Vegas, whatever it was, a couple of years ago. And I told Bill and Spencer Haywood, I was like, man, I'm thinking about just taking my name out of consideration.
No, I'm the
Erica Kane, the Susan Lucci of the Hall of Fame. She got nominated, Chris, for about 19
all
Emmys.
All my children,
and never won. She may have won one toward the end, but I feel like the Susan Lucci of the NBA. But no, but they were both like, no, don't do that, you know. And as long as my peers, Walt Frazier, gave me a great phone call the morning after I didn't make it. And everybody just kind of same thing. Like, yeah, man, you're a hell of a player. And don't let this define how you feel about you. And I don't. I mean, I understand what it's all about. So anyway, but congratulations to you, brother. And it's funny because, you know, there's a little bit of haterism on my part. You know, when guys like make it and I don't make it, it's like I ain't gonna listen to the speech. So I said that about Bobby Dandridge. I said that about but I always listen to the speech. And I listened to your speech, man. And it just
well, I'm in a different room.
Well, yeah, but still.
If you blink, you miss my day.
But still, that moment. What was that like for you, man? What was that when you found? How'd you find out that you were a Kurt Gowdy Hall of Fame recipient?
I knew I was a candidate, but you know when they called, you know, it wasn't until they announced it. At All-Star Weekend in Utah that I truly believed it. Like, I need them to say it into the front of the whole world.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it was one thing, you know, I was born in the show-me state, man. You had to show me. So when they announced it to everybody, I believed it, right?
Right.
But the most beautiful thing about it was, you know, my mom got to go, and she's in the front row with all these superstar NBA peers next to her. You know, my wife was there, but my dad, he had ALS, so he couldn't go.
Okay.
So, you know, God bless my sister. She went to New Orleans to be with my father so he could watch.
Okay.
Watch it with her and watch it on TV. And he was bedridden, and the only thing that was working magnificently was his mind. ALS robbed him of everything. And so he was able to watch the whole speech, man. Like, and I got to give him his flowers, got to talk about the ills of ALS.
Mm.
And so next time I went to New Orleans, I told my dad that I had my ring with me, right? And he couldn't speak, but he could moan, right? And he's like, I went back, I left the room, came back. He's like, Like, what are you moaning about?
Let's see that ring. Let's see the blade.
Want to see that ring? And then I brought it in the room. I put it on his finger. It says Spears on one side.
Oh my!
Hall of Fame on the other side. And I said, Dad, we made it, man. Yeah. We made it. And that's one of the most beautiful moments of my life.
Yeah.
Because you know he certainly played a big role in all my successes and the support. And I remember one time he was. Retirement jobs. He was driving some dude around. He's like, man, how your son get that job? He said, because my son's good at it.
Yeah.
Like, what you mean how my son get that job, right? But he passed away, Curtis Spears, man. He passed away in January. And I think he kind of like, in a crazy story, like, he passed away when I came in town in late January. And I think he wanted me to be there for my mom when he took his last breath. And so the fact that he got to put on the ring, got to see it, that was as amazing as that whole thing was. The fact that he saw it before he took his last breath, man, that certainly means the most to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's something, Mark, because when my mother was in her last days, one of the things I kept saying to her that I thought really gave her some strength was like, you can't go yet. You know, we got to get back to, we got one more trip to base. She saw my Jersey retirement as did everyone else in Milwaukee. And I said, we got one more. She hadn't been on a plane in 30 years. But she came back to Milwaukee, flew back to Milwaukee for that Jersey retirement. And I said, we got one more plane trip. We got to go back to Springfield. She kind of looked up and smiled at me and passed away in January, a couple of years ago. So didn't get to see it, but I could so relate to your dad and the pride
the fact
that
she must
have.
She got to go to Milwaukee. Jersey go up. Come on, man.
Yeah, like a day before a birthday, day before a 92nd birthday or something. Like, so
And the whole arena sang happy birthday to
him. Yeah, serenaded her with happy birthday.
Like, they serenaded her.
Like, you can't buy that.
Oh, no, no, that was...
you can't buy that, man.
Special. Chills.
So now, Hall of Famer, Mark J. Spears. Mark Joseph or Joseph, right? Joe. Okay, yeah. Mark
Joe
Joseph
Mama.
Spears.
To those
Joe Mama. Mark Joe Mama Spears. But how did you get so good, man, as a writer? What do you credit for your writing skills, your writing development? Kind of just give us a little bit of background on that. And was it just something naturally that you had an affinity for right away?
I knew I wanted to be a sports writer from the seventh grade, and I was really, really blessed. Like, one thing I, you know, hope is something that, I mean, if there's a way I could play in a role in it, like career days, man, for kids, it's huge. They're huge, especially, I think, for junior high kids, because I think that's when you're the most impressionable. You know, high school kids think they know everything in a lot of ways and may not be listening as much. And I don't want to speak for all high school kids, but I do think you need to know in junior high what you're like. It pains me to hear somebody say in college they don't know what they want to do. I knew what I wanted to do in the seventh grade. And basically what happened was a guy from the Warriors came to my junior high, Sylvandale Junior High in San Jose. And I just listened to him because he was hoop. I wanted hoping to get a free ticket or something like that. I think he was in PR. And for some reason, he asked me, like, I think God told him to ask me, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? And he goes, and I'm like, I want to play for y'all. I want to play for y'all. And he's like, well, I'm not going to say that you're not, but you can't play basketball forever. So what are you going to do when you can't play basketball anymore? What if the NBA doesn't call? And I'm like, I don't know. He told me, if you combine what you love most in life with what you do best in school, you'll find a job that you're happy with every day. And that is some advice I truly take to heart. I tell kids all the time. And so I was great in English and I sucked in math and science. And I love sports. So in the seventh grade, I decided to be a sports writer. I had a teacher by the name of Miss Thompson. She made everybody in our class write a letter to somebody that on the field that we were interested in. Not an email, a letter. And I wrote a letter to Mark Purdy, who was a columnist at the San Jose Mercury News. And he wrote me back in the seventh grade and told me everything I needed to do to be a sports writer. He gave me the cheat code.
Yeah,
wow.
It'd be like you giving some seventh grader what to do to be a great basketball player. He gave me the cheat code as a journalist. It's like, write on the school paper or the school yearbook now. Cover sports. I did that. I covered the eighth grade flag football team when I was a seventh grader. That's where Mark J. Spears came from. You go look at those stories. I was writing in the seventh grade, high school. He said, write on the school paper. I did that. We had a guy named Mick Van Valkenburg, who was our school paper teacher, who wrote at the San Jose Mercury News. So I got to be around a journalist every day. And we had a great English teacher. So I took the top English classes and I took typing classes. 1, 2, and 3, became a master typist. Wow. And then he said, when you get to college, not only write on the school paper, major in journalism, also minored in psychology, which I think helped me with the mentality of looking into, as a former athlete who studied psychology, that kind of helps me listen a lot better when I'm doing interviews and pick things that people wouldn't normally pick and ask questions that are different. But I wrote on a school paper every year I was in college. I did 3 internships, joined the National Association of Black Journalists. My first internship I did for free. Then I also interned in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And my last internship was in Dallas Morning News. And so I remember when I was in DC, Coach Ed Epps, God rest his soul. He said, man, if you care about basketball as much as you do that journalism, you'd be a hell of a player. Like, Coach, I'm playing at UDC, Coach. I ain't going to the league. I better concentrate on this journalism. And I'll tell you what, man, like my first job, I covered Arkansas after they lost to UCLA.
Okay. Okay.
Covered Nolan Richardson.
All right.
Like my first job, I'm covering Nolan, man. You know how big that is? What other coach am I going to be intimidated by as a journalist? I'm covering Nolan Richardson. I'm covering the SEC. Most kids out of college get high school. I was covering SEC. 2 years later, I went to the LA Daily News. I was covering the Angels and the Dodgers. A lot of people forget that or don't know that. And then I realized that while doing that job that I missed covering basketball, I need to get back. So I went to the Courier-Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. I did Kentucky and Louisville. And then in 99, I got the job covering the Denver Nuggets. And I think the thing that helped me was, as a former player, like, I know the game probably much more differently than most writers. I wasn't in the NBA, but I've been in the locker room. I've been on the bench. I've been a star. I've been the scrub. You know what I mean? I understand all that. Having studied psychology, I remember Kobe Bryant told me one time, he said, man, you always ask some Dr. Seuss-ass questions to me. And I took it as a compliment, man, because I think he always was like, this dude always asked some different questions. But Antonio McDice also told me once, he said, I could tell you used to hoop by the questions you ask.
And
Greg Popovich told me I'm fair. Wow. Like, so if I got the Dr. Seuss ask questions, fairness, and know the game,
I think
it gave me a step ahead. And I love to storytell, man. My dad, my uncles, all great storytellers. And, I mean, everybody knows the box score. Everybody knows the averages. But I think, ultimately, if you really love the game of basketball, you want to know about the player. You want to get over, you know, the bridge and get to know them as people. And I've been blessed with the ability to give them comfort that if I tell their story, that it's going to be told right. And I've had been blessed that a lot of players have really, really put their guard down and allow me to tell their truths, their stories, their pain, their triumphs, which is, you know, perfect with ESPN's landscape, man. So I think all that in a nutshell, you know, kind of answers the question you just asked me.
And you talked about, you know, telling the story more in depth in a different way. We had Zora Stevenson on, one of my favorite people.
Big time.
And she was like you, had a chance to cover the Olympics. Man, what was that? What was that? Have you covered many Olympics? Any Olympics? Just what's your history with that, and what was that experience like for you?
Well, the only one I ever covered was in 2008, which was a great one, especially if you're doing basketball. So I covered a Redeem team. Although Michael Lee from the Washington Post had a major food poisoning incident during the first fourth quarter of that game. And I went into the bathroom and helped him get his stuff together as much as possible before he went in the ambulance and got taken away. And so I still need to go watch that game. I didn't see most of the fourth quarter because I was trying to help my friend stay alive. And this is like a true story. But I covered that Olympics and hadn't covered one, you know, since then until I got the opportunity to go to Paris. And so I was with the great Bill Roden, who also legendary writer, columnist, works for Antscape. But my job was to cover men's and women's basketball, not just USA, but everything. So, of course, I wrote about all the men's players in USA and their triumphs and stuff like that. I did a diary with Jewel Lloyd. I also went to Rudy Gobert's hometown, St. Quentin, France, interviewed his sister. He has a court. Two beautiful courts, man. One with a picture of him when he was young, just starting playing, and one of the pictures say now, of him now, and then Miller says, you know, just a kid from St. Quentin. I also wrote about Dennis Schroeder being a black German and waving the flag during opening ceremonies for Germany and what kind of symbol that was. So, you know, was able to do a lot of different things. For fun, I snuck out, though. I went and saw Lyles in the 100. I had to go see that. Man. I had to go see, use my credential to see some track and field a little bit. But I was at that Serbia game, which is against USA, which may be the greatest basketball game I've ever seen in my life. And I was, you know, at every USA game, including the France game. So it was an amazing experience. I stayed for like 10 days after, went to London, went and saw my beloved Arsenal play. Y'all made me turn off my soccer watching Real beforehand, but we also went to Bordeaux, we went to Champagne, we went to Paris, Disneyland, like I was milking everything I could, you know, obviously in the preliminary round, I went to Lille, I fell in love with France again, and just got back last week.
Mark, who do you think, just from your vantage and covering all the teams and covering all the basketball squads over there, who do you think should have been named the Olympic MVP if not LeBron? Do you think LeBron deserved it, or do you think Steph or maybe somebody else might have deserved some consideration?
No, respectfully, I would have said Stephen Curry based on those last two games. Like, it's funny, me and Tom Tober got an argument on the radio out here because he mentioned, he said, you know, LeBron had the better tournament, and, you know, certainly you could make a strong argument for that, but to me, like, they don't beat Serbia unless Steph goes off, right? What do you have, 36, 38, something like that? And in the championship game, I don't know if I saw a last 230 as electric on fire as that. Like, I don't know. Mr. Johnson might be able to tell me something better. And I will certainly defer to you because you've been watching basketball for a long time. And they should always, people should always defer to you and your era for who is the true GOAT.
Yeah.
But that last 230 from Curry, those threes, the degree of difficulty, the time and place, the stress of the situation.
Yeah.
That was about as dominating, amazing, stunning. And I, being in the Bay, I see Steph all the time. But even then, I was like, whoa, that's just a new chapter that he's added to his already grown legacy. So, but I don't really even know how they voted for it. Like, I think Brian Windhorst was saying that it was like people voting on a QR code. And Brian mentioned it to LeBron. I don't even think he really, he's like, all right. I don't even know if he did. He get a trophy for it.
Well, they opened it up after the quarterfinal game, or something.
Yeah,
it was an interesting timing.
I don't know that anybody from USA cared about anything other than the fact that they got gold.
Facts. But Mark, to follow up on that, right? So I asked Zora about the vibes, the atmosphere between Paris and the 2021 Bucks championship. Now I want to ask you the same question. Just about, you've been around. Were you in the building for the Warriors? Any of the Warriors titles? You're in the building,
right?
I've
been in every NBA final since.
Yeah. So that was a dumb question. So in all your finals experiences, how does the gold medal game in Paris this past summer compare to the greatest finals you've ever been to?
It's different, man, because you got USA on your chest. It's not a job. It's USA on your chest, right? You're playing for a country. Like I was telling people, this is the first time everybody could root for LeBron in our country. It's the first time everybody
root
for Steph. Everybody root for Durant, right? Like
yeah.
You have people that hate the Warriors, but if you're an American during the Olympics, you can root for Steph and it's okay. And so to me, like, you know, that's different. Like I've seen some really, really amazing games in the finals over the last 25 years. And, you know, I thought the Ray Allen game with Miami, the Robert Horry shot in the corner for San Antonio at Detroit. Like, to me, those were like the two greatest probably games that I'd ever been to. I mean, I put a lot of precedence on it being in the finals, but like that semifinals game, like that was like finals are legacy shaping. But could you imagine if LeBron and Steph and KD and them dudes had bronze medals on their necks?
No,
like how embarrassing that they would have had to play in a bronze medal game.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I remember being like 5 or 6 minutes left. I'm like, whoa, I'm about to have a long night.
Yeah,
I had to do a Sports Center hit. I wasn't really planning on writing. Now I got to write. Like I was, and then it wasn't until Joker after that three pushed AD to the ground that changed the whole game.
Yeah.
You know that changed the also that you know the finals game where the Cleveland won at Golden State after being down 3-1. That was an amazing game to be at too.
Yeah.
Obviously, the atmosphere in Oracle and in Boston and in Philly, because even though Philly didn't win, my first finals game I think I covered was Lakers-Philly.
Ooh, Iverson. And
Iverson's only finals appearance. And
Dikembe.
I just remembered how electric it was in Philadelphia at that time. But Olympics has a different weight, man. 40 minutes. It's on steroids. It's fast.
Yeah.
And that team had so much weight on them because of the stars. And like they could have got certainly hated on for the rest of their lives if they would have got like LeBron with two bronze medals. That don't sound right.
Right.
They would have been calling him LeBron's James. You know what I mean?
Like, easily. Like,
it was funny. I heard Anthony Edwards say this, like, I ain't never seen KD play defense like that before. I never seen Steph play defense like that before in that game.
No, they dug deep.
They was playing like their mamas was in a cage above the arena, like with their lives on the line. So, I mean, the team basketball that they displayed to come back and win that game was incredible. It was beautiful. It was so I just yeah, I mean, there certainly has been some intense environments, some intense games, some, but Olympics is just, it's different because it's country. It's the whole country rooting for or against you.
And Mark, to follow up on that and staying on the Olympics, right? So you had a story about Dennis Schroeder carrying the German flag. Giannis carried the Greek flag. LeBron had the American flag, also with Coco Gauff. I find it, do you find any symbolism where countries like Germany and Greece now have, you know, African descent athletes carrying the flag?
Yeah, no, it was beautiful to see. And Schroeder was very open talking about it. Giannis didn't do a lot of interviews, man. I wish he would have talked more. Joker didn't do any, really. You know, I'm old school, man. You got to talk whether you win or lose to me. And I respect both of them tremendously as players to the highest of levels, but to you know, they don't have to talk to us, and they didn't. And but inevitably, that allows everybody to just guess what your story is. And
sure,
you know, so I appreciate Dennis Schroeder giving me. Dennis Schroeder called me, talked to me for a half an hour on the phone during the Olympics to talk about his experience as a flag bearer and what it meant to his family, what it meant to, he said, black kids, kids of color, you know, people that are, you know, certainly, you know, criticized for not being traditional German, so to speak. And so he actually, because they had a game the next day, they weren't going to have the German team, men's basketball team, come to the opening ceremony. And he fought for them to be like, look, nah, this is important. I know we're 2 hours away. I know we'll be a little tired, but we got to be a part of this. This is, so he, once he kind of got an inkling that he could be the flag bearer, he definitely wanted to do that to make a statement that despite people being racist against him while he was a child, talking about his skin color and everything, that he still was able to hold the flag. And I'm sure there was kids all over Germany that saw that and were inspired by that. And then also racist people who saw that, and hopefully they changed their hearts because of it. So that was beautiful to see for Giannis, what they went through as children to hold that flag, man. Like, I know being in the Olympics seemed to mean a lot to him, right? And to be the flag bearer for your country that beat your family up when you were a child, that's history, that's success, that's perseverance. Like, for him to be able, like, that, like, you could never take that experience away from him. And that's motivation for any African family that moves to Greece and is trying to find their way in this world. There's so many, Dennis Schroeder talked about, he said, there's so many African families that go to Europe. You know, people come to America for American dream. They go to Europe for a European dream to try to, you know, get a better life, try to figure it out and get a better life for their children. And Giannis's parents, you know, gave their boys a better way of life by, you know, basically putting their life in peril and challenge by going to Greece.
Yeah. Well, look, man, you said a couple of things here that have really got me thinking about some of the current stuff that's out there. You talked about Steph and Raymond Ritter, the PR guy with Golden State, great Raymond Ritter. He gave us a note that Steph had only hit 4 3-pointers in the final 230, like once in 1,000 games, playoff wow. and playoff.
Of course, Raymond
season.
Ritter gave you that.
It's a great note on that. But that, so another buddy of mine, Bill Bailey, down in North Carolina, he refereed Steph's games when Steph was a 10th grader. He told me, guys, that Steph came out as a 10th grader, 14, 15, skinny little kid. But normally how kids warm up with layups or close-in shots, he started out shooting near midcourt. And he said it was the craziest thing he'd ever seen. And then Steph became who Steph was. Now, this brings me to this point. You also mentioned Anthony Edwards. Anthony Edwards talked about how the only person that had skill back in the day was Michael Jordan. I'm pretty sure you're aware of that quote. Kevin Garnett followed that up with you know, his blistering rebuttal to Anthony Edwards in terms of just not being familiar with the players of that era enough to make that kind of a comment. Yeah. So you've been around for a long time. I like this topic because it's great podcast fodder, but at the same time, Mark, you know, it pains me a little because it seems like we're the only sport that cannibalizes its older generation and discounts what the older generation. Football, nobody ever talks about Gale Sayers and the fat lineman and the slow lineman that he was running around, or baseball before integration and Babe. You know what I mean? That goes unchallenged. But basketball, especially in the Twitterverse, let me put it like that, online, which is a whole other entity, but it just seems like there's this movement afoot to really discount what the players in the 70s and 80s, especially 80s and 90s, were able to accomplish, how they would stand up against today's superstars. You know, and Kevin Garnett, what did he say, Chris? He said that 20 years ago, a lot of these guys, you mentioned Jason Tatum, wouldn't be able to hang 20 years ago. Just want to get, you know, your take on that convoluted setup that I just gave you.
Yeah. Well, let me first talk about Kevin Garnett, who I had the pleasure of covering. You see that picture behind me? It's when I covered the 2008 NBA championship. The writer for the Boston Globe covering the Celtics. And that program, half of it, it was an amazing program, whoever did it. And I got my credential up there, and a friend of mine gave them their ticket, and that was a story I wrote on the championship. But it's half Kobe's face, half Garnett's face.
Okay.
If you really look at it, you can kind of see it.
Right.
But Garnett was a historian. Garnett knew about the history of the game, man. And so, coincidentally, you know who that is, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, for those people that don't know, this is Earl Lloyd, the big cat, right? Earl Lloyd, I'm going to take this down. I met him like 20-something years ago at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. Hit it off with him, asked if I could go to Clarksville, Tennessee to interview him. And he allowed me to. Earl Lloyd was the first black player drafted. I mean, to play in an NBA game, not drafted. Okay, Chuck Cooper was the first one drafted. Sweetwater Clifton was the first one to get a contract.
Okay.
But he gave me this. Footprints, right? Or handprints, I'm sorry. Earl Lloyd, he pinned this. He actually signed this. He put my name in there, right? It's one of the most prized possessions I have. And when I was covering the Celtics, Mr. Lloyd, God rest his soul, he wanted Garnett to have one. So he made the same kind of monogram for Kevin Garnett, personalized to him, signed it, and he gave it to me to give Garnett. And so I gave it to Garnett. I told him it's something from Earl Lloyd. He ended up opening it around Christmas, and the next time I saw him, he's like, man, thank you. It's one of the greatest gifts I ever got in my life.
Yeah.
Like, Garnett knew the history of the game. Robert Pack told me a story that when he played for the Timberwolves, it was toward the end of Pack's career, and Garnett in Minnesota had his own shower. Nobody used that shower, right? Like, that was Garnett's shower. Nobody else went there. So Pack, like, signed midway through the season. He like used the shower, not knowing it. No one told him anything. He just went and used the shower. And so his teammates were like, oh man, what you gonna say to him? What are you gonna say to him, man? He using your shower, KG. He's like, man, you see how many stripes on that man back? You see how many stripes on that man back? I ain't saying nothing to that man. You can take a shower anytime you want. He got stripes, meaning years in the league.
Right.
And he just knew the history. And I think now, like, in terms of podcasts, basketball, because its popularity, probably has more podcasts than any other American sport, right? No, there's not a zillion football podcasts, or they're just a lot. And so basketball players are popular. They got the most commercials. You know their faces more than baseball guys. They got hats on, football got helmets on. NFL only promotes the quarterbacks and the wide receivers, right? Some running backs, I guess, tight ends. But all the basketball stars are well known. And so I just think that this is like the realm of hot takes. There's just so many hot takes. And unfortunately, when you have those hot takes, you get comments like that. And so that's why, like, when I talk to you, Mr. Johnson, when I talk to Bill Duffy, like when I talk to the late, great Al Adams, who just passed, like, I feel like I'm in class. Because you guys could tell me how good Jerry West was.
Right.
You could tell me how good Elgin Baylor was. You could tell me how great John Havlicek was, right? Or the dominance of – I got to know Wilt Chamberlain a little bit before he passed. And so the time talking to Earl Lloyd in person on the phone, the time I got to talk to Al Addles at Warriors games, like, to me, those are master's classes, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think what the NBA needs to do, I don't know what they do with NBA TV in this new deal, but there's someone told me once, like, there's a place in LA that has all these old NBA films, just like some little studio. They purchased all of them. They're just sitting there collecting dust. Like, the NBA needs to buy those, scour the country, the world, to find as many NBA tapes as possible. I think it'd be great if, like, NBA TV showed a game of the day, OG game of the day, right?
Yeah.
And had somebody like you talking about your game next to it. So I just think the education is bad, and the younger generation are the ones that control what Instagram and, you know, what those videos look like. You ain't posting videos like that. Right? Yeah. So it's going to be their view of how they see the world and how uneducated a lot of times they see the world in terms of the history of basketball. And so I just, you know, I'm sure Anthony probably would want to take that back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Cause it's a lack of education on the history.
Right. What's funny, you mentioned Earl Lloyd.
And when he was born.
Yeah.
I mean, I got what they say. I got shoes older than that boy. You know what I mean?
But Earl Lloyd, couple of points about Earl Lloyd, and I haven't really formulated this thought, but this whole kind of, they always split up the honor about the first black African-American in the NBA between Chuck Cooper, between Sweetwater Clifton, between Earl Lloyd. I think Earl Lloyd was the first one to actually play in a game. I believe there was a contract signed. There was one drafted, I think Chuck Cooper. But to
Chuck Cooper was drafted first in like the third round.
But it's like, who got
Earl
on the floor?
Lloyd went
who
in
played?
The sixth round.
Who played?
Well, I mean, like, they all played the 1950-51 season.
But who got on the court first?
They all should be celebrated the same because neither one of them had control of the schedule. And Earl Lloyd's game just happened to be the first one on Halloween 1950. Okay. But they all played that season, right?
Right.
They all suffered the same pain in terms of, you know, not being able to sleep in the same hotel.
Yeah.
Earl Lloyd told me stories about people asking him if he had a tail.
Wow.
A tail, right? Yeah. Like Chuck Cooper not being able to get on the same train as his teammates. And then also there was racism within the team, within some of these coaches. Like if you talk to Chuck Cooper's son, you should bring like Chuck Cooper's son, still alive. He knows all the stories. So, you know, Big Cat's sons. So is Sweetwater Clifton's daughter who's in Chicago. Like, they could tell you all these stories, but I know a lot of times in the 50s, and then, like, Chuck Cooper was a great offensive player at Duquesne, but they didn't want the black player to be the offensive star of the team at that time.
Facts.
Like, Al Addles used to tell me in the 50s and early 60s, they typically didn't have more than three black players on a team.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So when you go to – there were players that, you know, retired, played for the Globetrotters, or stopped playing at all because – if you go to camp and you know that three black players were locked in, I don't care how nice you were.
Yeah. And when I got in the league in 77, I mean, that was a kind of an unwritten rule, especially Midwestern places, Milwaukee, Kansas City. There was this six white players, six black players. It wasn't going to be. And this was like a year or two in. And then after that, it kind of shifted dramatically.
When winning started to matter?
Well, the Knicks wound up having like the Knicks or the N-word Bockers, as they were called back then. They had like an all-black team in the early 80s. But it was just an interesting time. But Chris, you weigh in on this, but we were talking about this just in terms of the current players not having an appreciation for the style of play, the travel, all the things, Chris, that we had kind of shared earlier. If you want to go into it a bit more with Mark.
No, I just think that like today's NBA guy was born during a generation where they just had access to a lot of stuff, whether it be better travel, medical stuff, training stuff, better equipment, shoes. Now, my point is understanding that my dad's era, they didn't have none of that. And them guys were still good. Them guys, athletically, if you look at the athleticism, Mark, MJ, 6'7", 40-inch vert, could run probably a 4'6", 40. Those numbers stack up across generations. This isn't like a thing. And now when they always want to talk about threes and skill. So basketball is going to stay basketball no matter what era we're going to play. So threes, you can go through the leg, behind the back, triple step back, or you can MJ pump fake two bounce dribble jumper.
Yeah.
Okay? It's still 2 points. Now, the three-point thing, you may have a little point, but like I say, the guys in the 70s and 80s would easily adjust to this culture today if they played for coaches that allowed them to miss 30-footers. What, Mark? When Mark Jackson took Steph and Clay and let them miss and stay in the game, so you're taking those shots, but you're missing at least 50% of them, and we're keeping you in the game. I came from an era where you just couldn't take any shots you wanted to, Mark.
Yeah.
Mark, you just can't come down jacking, or you might never see the floor again. Oh, man, so these guys.
I think about some players now, like from the 80s, that, like, imagine Kiki Vandeweghe now.
Oh.
Right, like,
please.
Like Brad Sellers, like, just was before his time.
Yeah,
he would have flourished.
Well, Richard Washington, my teammate at UCLA, he was a sweet shooting 6'11 big who was too soft to play in the post. So get your ass out of here because you don't belong in the NBA because you're not tough enough to get that. Yeah. And he had the sweetest jumper. I called him McAdoo. His jumper was so sweet at 6'11. So
it was a different time.
But see, back then, Mark, it was like how close you could get. Back then, 50% was the yardstick. If I shot below 50% 1 year, I had a broken hand, but the Clipper shot about 46. And, that just gives me – it's an eyesore. Well, I remember
Ricky Berry bringing him back. Like, he shot – made an NBA record in 89. He made 8 threes in a game.
Wow.
Damn.
Yeah.
And he probably did it on 12 shots, right? They didn't have that opportunity. Like, I mean, if Larry Bird could take all the many threes in a game, come on, man. To me, Larry Bird is the most disrespected NBA superstar of all time. Like, for him not to have his name ever mentioned.
With the great
in all-time great conversation. Hey, man, I used to love Sunday mornings, turning on the Celtics. He used to cook brothers, man. It used to be funny watching them cook. Him and Chuck Person going at it.
Bird,
like, Bird was cold, man.
Well, and this is the thing about Larry Bird, and I heard Antonio Daniels, who I love. I love he and I think Rick Campbell have a show on Sirius that I listen to on a regular basis. But he was talking about Bird just this morning. He was talking about how he was didn't know no athleticism, no this. And I'm like, I've seen Bird reverse dunk on dudes.
Yeah.
You know, come down the baseline, go to the opposite side, throw one down. And yeah, granted, he's 6'8", 6'9", but that whole thing about him being super slow, non-athletic, is way overblown. I played against the guy, and he had the quick twitch movement in a small compartment. You know, he wouldn't beat you in a foot race, maybe, but in that small compartment, he was just as quick as anybody.
Technical.
Getting one bounce dribble, pull-ups, whatever. He had that kind of quickness, which is the kind of basketball quickness.
He was so cold, Dr. J tried to choke the man. Like, come on, man. How you get under Dr. J?
But Mark,
MJ, to cut you off, but I just think about just like one of the things that I always talk about, and that no one really likes to have this conversation about today's player versus the old school era, because, you know, they always try to act like, you know, we're calling today's player punks, or that they're soft, or that they don't have the intestinal fortitude to compete in an era where you're allowed to play a certain level of physicality. The societal norms were a lot different. So back when we played, fights, elbows to the mouth, things like that weren't punished by you're excommunicated for 15 games. No, play on, wipe the blood off, let's go. So my point is this. How do you take into account when you evaluate generations the physicality and the societal norms part of, because we don't talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like we, it's just, it's really unfair because if we put Zach Edey in the '80s, Zach Edey's probably the number one pick, right?
Yeah.
Yes, like, think sir. About that. Imagine Zach Edey in the '80s. Oh man, he would have been shoot.
Excited.
So it's just a different era now, man. Analytics changed everything. Steph Curry changed everything. You know, the three is certainly more valuable then. You know, Steph Curry would have probably got beat up in the '80s.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people don't talk about hand checking. Like, what would Michael Jordan do right now?
Yeah,
Michael Jordan in his prime right now would have certainly learned how to become a great 3-point shooter. Knowing his work ethic, Michael Jordan would average 40 right now. Easy.
Yeah, of course.
Well, and I was telling Chris that Don Nelson, Mark, used to tell us that any decent offensive player, this is back in the 80s, that you allow five dribbles or more is going to score. They're just too good of players not to score and get to their spot and jump over you. And now, guy, it's routine to have 10, 15, 17 dribble possessions on some isolation. James Harden,
drives
I'm thinking about
nuts
some other guys. You know, just bouncing the air out the ball, which is today's game. But I'm just saying it's a different era, and I just wish the young people of today, like you say, would educate themselves, but also just would show a little bit more reverence.
They're a product of their environment, right? And so, like, there's different guys. It's like Trey Murphy. When he first came in the league, he came up to me and introduced himself and said, like, you know, he really respected my work and he had been reading me for a while. So I think it's mutually exclusive to each guy. So I don't think you should paint every player as
sure
facts.
You know, there's certainly a lot of guys who know about the history of the league or came from fathers or mothers who really followed it and know it. And you know, Anthony, he probably didn't watch basketball that much. Like he'd tell you that.
Yeah. No, he
know,
said.
So I think that's like it's kind of a question, a leading question to ask him because it's easy to get him to bite on that, right? But I bet you if you ask him how much 80s basketball has you watched, he's like, I just seen some Jordan highlights.
He said it. I haven't watched a whole lot of that. And so speaking of Trey Murphy, and we're going to bring it back current times just to get you out of here. We really appreciate your time, Mark. But Trey Murphy, is he better than Chris Middleton as a small forward? What would you say just off the top of your head? If you had to rate
the team. You got to be all-star first.
Okay, so they had him ranked as like the 15th or 16th best ball. They had Chris Middleton at number 22. And I know Chris is coming off a double ankle surgery, but
Trey Nice now. Trey Nice,
yeah,
don't get me wrong.
Trey Murphy and Will Herb Jones.
Chris is injury induced.
But so that made no sense. But then also this whole idea about Giannis being the fourth best player in the Eastern Conference. Just I'll give him Embiid.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah.
I love you. How long I known you?
For at least a decade, maybe more.
Why do you care?
Why do I care?
Why do you care how somebody wrecks somebody?
Well, you know, we're doing podcasts. It's podcast
talk. Why do you, of all people, care?
Well, no, and I'll tell you, I told my daughter this the other day.
I know Chris is laughing at that. Like, why are you by that?
I told my daughter the other day, it's like Sidney Wicks told me, Mark, when I was playing against him at 15, 16 years old, and I didn't say a word, but I was balling. And Sidney was like, I like you. You let your game do your talking.
Yeah,
you let your game do the talking. And so that's always been my approach.
I always say beauty in the eye of the beholder, man. Yeah. I like sugar on my grits, and I get beat up about that all the time.
Sugar. You're sugar on your grits, dude.
No, I ain't say I got butter, and that's, you know, I learned that from my dad from St. Louis, man. That's what he taught me.
No, I'm definitely hip to that, man. I'm a salt and butter guy myself, man. But yeah,
but does that make me a bad guy?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Beauty's an eye of the beholder, man. Like when people had these opinions, it's just so many, man. We
We try to get clicks, man. We need clicks, brother. You're not biting on the clicks, man. We try to get clicks, and you ain't biting. Come at me all rational, Mr. Johnson. What do you care? Like, I really don't.
Because that's man. Me, though. That's
yeah,
me,
I really
though.
Don't.
It ain't got nothing to do with... I know.
Yeah.
But, you know, perhaps, you know, that's just how I see the world, man.
Yeah. But it's the beauty
everybody,
of it is that...
Magic Johnson to me is the greatest... You want your click? Magic Johnson is the greatest basketball player of all time.
And you get no argument from me whatsoever. Whenever they leave him off these all-time great teams, I'm like,
it's absurd. They played five positions, made everybody better.
They just don't know.
Why he's not in that argument, I have no idea.
I have no idea.
And I've argued with Kenyon Martin about this and Tony Parker, and I'm like, Magic Johnson's cold, bro.
Yeah, they don't know. I mean, people don't realize he won three championships over a 4-year period: high school, college, played Michigan center. State, and then rookie year against the Sixers.
Played
you know,
center. Well, how many players could do that? Change a position.
Yeah,
if somebody got hurt. Okay, I'm gonna dramatically change. Well, you could.
Forget about playing center. How about dropping 42 and what 15, 16 assists or whatever. Yeah. You know,
in a
closeout game, six against the Sixers to Dr. J. So
big fella, I got this cap and I got this.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. So anyway, man.
There's your click. There's your click now.
Well, give me another
Magic
click.
Magic Johnson. And the Bucks. I said,
What do you got for the Bucks this year?
I think Dame's going to have an outstanding year.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I think with Dame, what happened with him off the court, I certainly know that there was a lot of pain with the transition in his life, with his change in his life, with his relationship, not being around his kids, coming to a new city for the first time. And you got to remember, he's an Oakland kid, right? So going to Portland wasn't too far. So now he's going into the Midwest for the first time, right? Portland cold winters and Milwaukee, two different worlds. So I think you're going to see a better him this year. Not that he wasn't great last year, but I think he's going to be on a vengeance tour. Who was that guy he was working out with? Come on, man.
Yeah.
You don't work out with that dude unless you're trying to be a superhero.
Yeah, the super
Grogan or something
David,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, David. Yeah,
man,
David.
Come on,
Goggins.
Man.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you got to be trying to be a Green Beret, you know, super active. I'm going to the Middle East to save people, kind of dude to train with that guy.
Yeah,
well, like, he training with him.
Yeah, the thing about that dude too, his philosophical stuff too is just really good. Which I think will benefit Dame just as much as all the physical stuff they're doing. But keeping Dame,
he listens.
Yeah.
He hears it.
Yeah.
He processes it. I think he and Giannis are going to be very scary together. Giannis just got to stay healthy, man. Just need him healthy. Like, for him to be hurt in the last two playoffs, like, the what-ifs with the Bucks, we'll never know. But that's 2 years of his prime that have been lost because of injuries in the postseason. So.
Right. Yeah, but I believe, Mark, things happen how they're supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And just in terms of Giannis' mental acuity and toughness and all, just going through what he's gone through the last couple of playoffs, Dame gone through what he's gone through, and the Bucks not being talked about right now with Paul and George and with the Sixers, the Celtics coming back.
You know what? I'm going to tell you this. That Trent pickup was a very nice pickup on the humble.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody's talking about that. But, you know, they played together in Portland. I've known this kid since he was a teenager. Prolific Prep. Shout out to Prolific Prep in Napa. He's a great compliment with Dame.
Yeah. And he's killed us.
That was a sneaky pickup I think is my boy Beauchamp, man.
What's up with Marjon, man? Is this a make or break year for Marjon?
I think he'll pick it up this year.
Okay.
I think he'll show improve this year. He's a fighter. He's had to fight his whole life. I think he does his best with his back against the wall. So I think I expect a breakthrough season from you.
Yeah. All right.
One thing on Doc, you covered Doc.
During the
Celtics run, they had a big three. He did a great job of managing and empowering guys. What do you think Doc is going to do this year with this big three in order to try to get the Bucks to that championship threshold?
Doc is the most hated on coach in the history of basketball. There's your other click.
Okay. We get clicks.
I just the 3-1 thing, man, is to me very overblown. Like, I was in the bubble. Them dudes didn't want to play. What is Doc supposed to do? T. Lou was on that staff too. What was he supposed to do? Them dudes didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
They blew a 3-1 lead. They could have been champions, and they weren't. You know, when he blew one in Philly, that team wasn't supposed to win that series anyway, right? I think that one day we'll have to appreciate that Doc Rivers is top 10 in wins.
Yeah.
He's top 10 in wins in this league. How often is that talked about? How often do you hear a game in which Doc Rivers is coaching where somebody mentioned that he's in the top 10 in the history of this league that's been around, what, almost 80 years now? He's top 10 in wins.
Yeah.
I think he might even be eighth. And it to me, it probably pains him if he was honest about it, open about it, that he doesn't get that kind of respect about his longevity, about his ability to, you know, have success with a lot of teams. Yeah, I mean, did everything go perfect? You know, ain't no coach perfect, right? Like, everybody has their ups and downs. But he's top 10. Like, we spoke about Hall of Fame. Doc Rivers better be a Hall of Fame coach.
Yeah, no, without question.
At some point. But to me, for him to not get respect for the amount of wins that he has had in this league and to be the second all-time winningest black coach, like only Lenny Wilkins has more than him, to be top, to be eighth? I believe he's eighth. Like, can we start talking about that more?
Yeah.
Like he deserves respect. He deserves his flowers. Yeah, everything didn't go great in the playoffs. But how many to say you're eighth all time in wins, man.
Yeah.
You got it. That deserves more respect.
Yeah, and then just his ability to manage situations from the Donald Sterling situation to the bubble stuff that went down. I mean,
Doc, me and James Posey had a beef, which is a long story I won't get into, in Denver, where it was over a story written where we both had something to question on both sides, right? And Doc found out about it when I started covering the Celtics. He's like, okay, like, we went to dinner before the season, or not when he started covering the Celtics, when I started covering the Celtics. We had dinner before they went to training camp in Rome. And Doc was like, hey, I told him a story with Posey, because he was asking what my relationships were with the guys. And Posey was the only guy I had covered. And he goes, I'm fixing that in training camp. He's like, you're going to be around the guys all year. You're going to be around the team all year. We can't have you and one of my players beefing. Yeah, okay, I just put it away. I wasn't thinking about it. We get to Rome, first day of practice. Practice is over. Doc talks to the media. So we're done. I'm just kind of hanging out, about to, you know, take off and go get some gelato and some wine or whatever, right? And he says, Spears, Posey, come here. Huh, okay. Calls us both over. Hey, man, y'all go sit down and talk and work this out. I don't need this hanging around us all season. I'm not even on the team.
Yeah.
No, I'm a writer, right? Like, I'm like,
yeah,
okay, coach, you know what I mean? So me and Posey went, sat, talked it out, dapped it up like two gentlemen, move forward. And that, to me, like, in a lot of ways, showed what kind of leader he was. Like, this man's going to be writing about us, writing about our history in the Globe. He's going to be around the guys all year. I don't need Pose, you know, salting him to the team. I don't need him having any animosity against Pose. Y'all two sit down and work this out, and I don't want y'all to leave until you get on the same page. We got on the same page, and Pose see me now. We give each other a hug, and, hey, man, what's up? What can I do? Like, what are you doing now?
Right.
And so that, to me, shows a lot about, like, I wasn't even on the team, and that's like Doc's leadership, you know.
Well, understanding people, understanding relationships, understanding what makes guys tick, understanding how to motivate guys, and that's where Doc doesn't get the credit that he deserves just based on the different personalities all during his illustrious. And I say that
he's coached the most Hall of Famers of all time, isn't that one of his things?
I'll give you one thing, it's a compliment, but it's funny too. Doc will lie to protect his players, man.
Yeah.
And he'll laugh when he hears me say that. I'm like, I know this ain't true. Oh, man, he fine. He all right. Yeah. Mark, you know they call Doc is a nickname. You know I ain't really a doctor, right? He would tell you that. But he's just like, Doc will lie to protect his guys.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's the kind of coach you want.
Right, right, right.
Somebody that. You know, there were some guys that had some stuff going on in that Celtics team, but like, you know.
You got to control the narrative, baby. You got to control that narrative.
He will die on that hill for his players, man.
There you go. There you go, man. Well, look, man, we appreciate it so much, you stopping by for an hour plus and hanging out with us, man, the Johnson fellas here on here District, man, and just keep up the great work that you're doing. And this has been a real joy for us. And please promise that you'll come back and do it again, man.
I'm honored to be on. And you know, me and Chris, we got a lot of love for each other.
Why y'all get so close? Where'd y'all get so tight?
It's Cali basketball, man. Okay. We know each other from Dayton, and then we send each other message about players, and we hold each other honest. But I think we both respect each other's basketball IQ, right?
Absolutely.
So, and then you just come on, man. You're a legend. Well, so, if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. Anytime you walk in a room, do I give you respect?
You give me major love.
Do I ever walk by you first time I see you at a game and not pay homage?
I told you, you came up to me at the Fine Serve Forum and told me I was getting into the Hall of Fame. Now, you weren't right on that, but just that kind of love. I went on air and talked about that. I said, Mark Spear just told me, you know.
That shows you what kind of juice I got, right?
Yeah, like, it made me feel good. It made me feel good that you acknowledged my career and where I stood as a basketball player. So it's not even about making it or not making it. It's just the fact that you acknowledged, you know, you gave that acknowledgement.
Hey, my jersey ain't in no rafter.
Well, it means something, though. It means something, Mark. It means something, too.
You're Springfield, brother.
No, I know.
You're Springfield, though. You're Springfield. No,
it's coming, Hoff. I'm gonna keep with it.
Okay. All right, we appreciate you, man. Thanks a lot, Mark. Mark Spears, love you too, man. Thank you.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.